restricting, you know, wages and benefits for postal workers. This is what we're up against. And even if the postal service, well, the deal is probably being made right now between the new Postmaster General and the Republicans in Congress to get a bailout, you know, you know, of an infusion of funds to keep the Postal Service running on the contingency that it be completely reformed, as they say, to benefit the private sector, which will be horrible for, you know,
everyone's,
yeah, seniors and veterans, particularly who get medications, mm-hmm. and who rural communities who depend on, you know, inexpensive and timely postal service. Yeah. So we're encouraging folks to call their congressperson and even the Democrats, because the Democrats have to stand up to the Trump administration and say, no, we're not going to give you any more breaks for corporations until you agree to keep the public postal service and fund it effectively.
Well, you know, the Trump administration will sneak around any time they can to take what's ours, and the postal service is definitely ours, and it has been for well over 200 years.
Exactly. So it's yours, keep it.
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, Jamie, it looks like we're running out of time.
We are
a little over time, in fact.
Well, that wraps it up then.
Yeah.
For tonight's Labor Radio, this Monday and every Monday from 6 to 6:30 at KBOO.FM or 90.7 on your FM dial. I'm Jamie Partridge.
And I'm Amanda Hill. Thanks for joining us.
Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are talking with Alice Lundell from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Welcome, Alice.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As of Friday, it was reported that the first Oregonian has died in prison. It says that he was between the ages of 50 and 60 years old, and he was housed at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and he has passed away of COVID-19. Do you know anything further about that case that you can share?
So we don't have any further information about that individual beyond what has already been made public. One thing that I would note about the person is that he was incarcerated at the Oregon State Penitentiary prior to his death in hospital. And that is notable because at the moment, OSP is the epicenter, we might say, of the outbreak of COVID-19 in Oregon prisons. So I think, you know, a very high proportion of the cases that there are in prisons are within OSP. I think it's about 110 out of 143 people who are infected across the system are at OSP. So that is where we're seeing the most serious outbreak. From our perspective as an organization, the Oregon Justice Resource Center has been, you know, speaking out about the threat that we perceive that COVID-19 poses to incarcerated people. That is, the prison environment is one that is particularly dangerous for the spread of disease because people live so closely together and because it's harder for people to practice good hygiene measures and because people in prison are averagely in worse health than the population outside, so they're already more vulnerable. So sadly, now that we have seen somebody within the prison system die from this disease, this is something that we have been afraid of happening since this crisis began, and something that we have been pressing the Department of Corrections and Governor Kate Brown to take action on to try to prevent this very scenario and the terrible loss that his family have now suffered.
Yeah, it says here about 110 people at OSP as of May 20th had tested positive for COVID-19 and 26 staff members. Do you know how many of those people that have tested positive for COVID-19 within OSP are considered medically vulnerable?
We don't have that information.
It's hard getting the data, isn't it? So the lawsuit, let's talk about the lawsuit and then we'll come back around to talking some more about this case. I received some information from OJRC earlier this week that one of the clients in your lawsuit has also tested for COVID-19. Can you talk about that individual?
That's right, yes. So one of our clients, David Hart, who is one of seven people who are named plaintiffs in our class action lawsuit against the Department of Corrections and Governor Kate Brown. David is incarcerated also at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and he has a respiratory condition. So that is something that would make him more vulnerable to bad outcomes from COVID-19. He was tested on May 14th, and that was after he lost his sense of smell and sense of taste, which I know is one of the things that people look for when they're looking for possible cases. And on May 15th, he got a confirmation of his positive test, and he has been moved into what's known as the disciplinary segregation unit. People also call it the hole. It's basically solitary confinement. But his reason for moving there is not a punishment, it's for medical isolation. So in order to keep him away from other people to help avoid the spread of disease. Although I would note that even though he is in segregation for medical reasons, one of the things that we have heard from people who have gone into isolation for medical reasons is that they're not necessarily being treated completely differently from people who are in segregation for punishment reasons. So really those segregation cells are not set up to provide people with their normal the normal privileges that they would have if they were in general population in the prison. So one of the harms that the approach that's being taken to COVID-19 in the prisons has is people experiencing almost kind of like a punishment for something that is just a medical condition, because those are the tools that DOC has to handle the situation.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the other plaintiffs in the lawsuit? Do you have their information?
Sure. So to give you an overview, this is a class action lawsuit. So this is a lawsuit demanding changes in the way that the Department of Corrections and Governor Kate Brown, because she's the person with the power to release people, are handling the management of COVID-19 in prisons. And there are seven people who are individuals who are currently incarcerated around the state in different prisons who are the named plaintiffs. And you can think of them almost as like these are examples of people who need to be protected from harm. But because it's a class action suit, it does in fact cover everybody who is incarcerated in a state prison. It doesn't cover local jails or other detention facilities. The seven people that we have as named plaintiffs, they're all either over 60 years old, or they have chronic health conditions that are recognized by health authorities as making them more vulnerable to COVID-19. And some of them actually fit into both of those categories. So generally, we have plaintiffs who we know are going to be more medically vulnerable to the disease, who have particular concern about being infected. And the goal of the lawsuit is to try to get the right actions taken to protect people so that we don't see as many people infected and that we don't see of course, any more deaths from this disease within the prison system.
So one of the issues that I'm seeing come up quite a bit with regard to the spread of COVID within the prison systems is that people who are incarcerated are not being allowed to wear face masks in under some circumstances. One of the things that I read in the lawsuit is that the client who did test positive for COVID-19, David Hart, one of his complaints was that he was not given a face mask.
So my belief now is that masks have been made available at this point. They weren't necessarily initially, but that they have been made available now to incarcerated people. Now, I believe people have only been issued a couple of them, and it is up to people to decide whether to wear them or not. So while staff have also received masks, as far as I'm aware, what we are hearing from people is that not necessarily everybody is taking this as seriously as we might hope. So there are people who aren't wearing their mask or aren't wearing it properly. And for the people that are particularly vulnerable, who do want to do everything they can to protect themselves, that's very worrying. And that's one of the challenges of being in an environment where you have very little control over your living situation. Because even if you're wearing your mask a lot, you do need lots of other people to be doing it too to help keep everyone safe. And we're not necessarily seeing that happening universally. But our understanding is that people do have some access now to masks.
What is the goal of the lawsuit, ultimately? What is the goal of the lawsuit?
The goal of the lawsuit is to try to keep as many people as possible within Oregon's prison system safe from COVID-19. And in order to do that, we need to see Governor Kate Brown and the senior leadership of the Oregon Department of Corrections taking the necessary steps to keep people safe. We've already seen the Department of Corrections basically admit that they would need a significant population reduction in order to achieve real social distancing, because prisons are not designed to allow people to be 6 feet apart at all times. There are too many people in these spaces. People sleep in small spaces together. So the only way you would achieve those kinds of distances is to just have fewer people in prison. We also need to see better provision of hygiene supplies around the prison system. And in order to achieve those things, Governor Kate Brown also has a role to play, because unlike in many other states, there's very limited power for the Department of Corrections to do anything about releasing people early from sentences. The way things are set up with the law in Oregon, it's very much about the governor being, you know, kind of the obvious person to wield that power. And then there is also some role for the Board of Parole. But most of the power on releases is with Governor Brown. So she is a key person who needs to act on this. And, you know, we need to see urgent action from the governor and from the Department of Corrections working together to find, you know, the best options for release for enough people to then keep the remaining population safe.
And has Governor Brown given any indication? I mean, I know that after the lawsuit was initially filed, there was a report that came out that listed approximately 3,000 people who might be eligible. But Governor Brown only released two people, one of whom I actually knew personally. But that leaves still 14,000 plus people at risk. What has Governor Brown responded to the lawsuit?
So what we haven't been able to do is achieve our goals of keeping people safe through kind of talking or negotiation with the governor's office or the Department of Corrections. We started out in this situation when this first really became clear how serious this was going to be in March, with an approach of trying to work with the governor's office, trying to talk to them, show them, you know, what was being said by experts on correctional systems, by experts on public health, and try to get them to come to an understanding and a willingness to act without litigation. I mean, it's never our, you know, desire to have to sue people. But it has not been possible to achieve, you know, a situation where they agree to do this voluntarily. So that is why we have turned to litigation. And, you know, it really has now become a situation where we are looking to the courts to compel Governor Brown and the Department of Corrections to do the right thing. That is sort of the tool that we have to use. Now, if Governor Brown wants to, you know, wants to decide now that she will act, then that is a fantastic news, and we would fully support that. But I think that we are, you know, we are really looking now to this legal process to play out and see what happens with that.
I want to talk about Coffee Creek for a minute because it's one of the facilities I'm really concerned about. I've been hearing reports from Coffee Creek that there's no cases, but I really have a hard time believing that. I've also heard reports from people within the Coffee Creek system that there are over 150 cases. Can you confirm or do you know anything about the status of Coffee Creek? It's not listed within the COVID page on the OJRC as having any confirmed cases at this time, but I'm really finding it hard to believe that almost 3,000 of the 14,000 state penitentiary population doesn't have any cases of COVID.
So we're reliant, like everyone else, in the information that the Department of Corrections releases around testing. And at the same time, we are talking to a lot of people around the state in different facilities. And we already provide legal services to people at Coffee Creek, which is work that we were doing before this whole situation began. So we hear from a lot of people who are at Coffee Creek or who are connected to people at Coffee Creek. What I will say is that the percentage of the total population of Oregon's prisons who have been tested is absolutely tiny. You know, it's a sort of handful of a percent of the total population have been tested. At Coffee Creek, which when I say Coffee Creek, I'm specifically talking about the women's prison and not the intake center that is there. At Coffee Creek, the women's prison side, you know, according to DOC, they've only tested 5 people, and none of those tests was positive. And thinking about what we're hearing from people, you know, not just at Coffee Creek, but generally, it seems like the numbers of tests happening, with the possible exception of OSP, now that that is the epicenter, the numbers of tests happening seem to be tiny relative to the numbers of people who are telling us that they or people they know are experiencing symptoms that could be connected to COVID-19. I mean, we can't know unless people are tested, but certainly the accounts that we have heard of mass sickness, people feeling unwell, in some cases very unwell, really over the last couple of months or so. I mean, this is not, you know, necessarily new. People have been feeling unwell in some cases for a while. So I think that given how low the testing numbers are at Coffee Creek and elsewhere, it's very difficult for us to say there aren't any cases. You know, I think that seems like a somewhat implausible thing to say, but we can't know unless the testing is done. If we had much wider spread testing, then we would have a much better handle on how many real cases there are. Because when we don't test, we have no idea how many people who are asymptomatic or have very minor symptoms and are basically feeling fine, how many of those people are going around spreading the disease within the facility because they haven't sought medical care because they don't realize that they're actually sick. So, you know, we do have to worry about getting a handle on this situation when we have so many people untested and therefore no way of knowing who are these no or low symptom spreaders of the disease.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Alice Lundell from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. The OJRC has been involved in a lawsuit suing ODOC and the governor and some administrators within the system regarding 7 plaintiffs who are medically vulnerable and at risk of COVID, including one who, since the initial lawsuit was filed, has contracted COVID-19. Why isn't everyone in the in ODOC being tested, it seems like it's the easiest possible population to test. You have 14,000 people who you know exactly where they are. You know exactly how to get in touch with them. It seems like the easiest possible population in the world to test. So why haven't we tested all 14,000 residents of the Oregon Department of Corrections?
Well, yeah, you're right to say that this would be, in theory, an easy population to test. And in some states, we have seen mass testing at certain facilities. And what they found typically when they've done that is pretty high rates, you know, and a lot of people who have the condition who didn't know they had it, which kind of speaks to what I was saying earlier about this fear that if people aren't being tested, there are no or low symptom individuals who are spreading the disease without even realizing what they're doing. So in terms of the testing, one thing I will say that we have heard, and which does speak to the way that this is being handled, is some people are signing waivers that they've been offered by DOC to say that they are declining testing, right? They're basically declining testing. Now, on the face of it, you would think, like, why would you say no to testing? Why would you not want to be tested? And the reason being is that people are worried about the consequences to them if they test positive. So even if their health is basically fine and they don't really need, you know, any significant medical treatment because their body is coping well with the disease, we're seeing people, as we talked about with David Hart earlier, people being taken to isolation and being put in cells that are designed for disciplinary isolation. But that's the place that DOC has to take people for medical isolation. So people are going into spaces that are not designed to allow you to live a life with the privileges you would usually have in the general population. So these are very Spartan, bare cells that don't have the access to the facilities that you would have in general pop. And the other thing that is happening is people are being transferred from the facility they're in to the Coffee Creek Intake Center. So that could be men or women. And the reason for that is because they have better facilities for medical care there. And people are worried that if they get transferred to Coffee Creek or to some other facility, because we've also heard about people moving between other facilities, that they're not going to get back to where they were, right? If they have managed to get themselves into a facility where they feel like their setup is reasonably good for them, and maybe they're near their family and friends, so it's easy for people to visit them, and people are concerned, you know, after I move to this other facility, am I going to stay there permanently, even once this crisis is over? Am I then going to get shipped on again to another facility? Many people within the prison system worry about ending up in one of the facilities way out in eastern Oregon, because of course, you know, most people are living in the Willamette Valley generally. And so if you get shipped out east, you could be a long way from your family and your friends, and that could greatly reduce the opportunities for you to have people come see you. So there's a lot of concern about people, you know, unwittingly destabilizing their situation by seeking testing or seeking help with symptoms that might be of this disease. So there is definitely a disincentive there for incarcerated people to seek help. And I think also, I'm not aware that even if people do want testing and don't have symptoms, you know, it certainly does, from what we're hearing, testing isn't available to just anyone who wants it, even if they did want to take the risk of those negative consequences. It's much more a case of if you have symptoms that strongly suggest COVID-19, or if you have been in close contact, like you're sharing a cell with somebody who is now diagnosed as a positive case, that's the kind of scenario where you'll get offered testing. But just generally, you know, if you're in a facility with no cases and you ask for testing, you know, we're not hearing that people can just get testing if they want it, you know, regardless of their exact circumstances.
It sounds like ODOC doesn't have any kind of plan or strategy for dealing with COVID-19 other than to basically let almost the entire population be exposed and contract it.
I think in fairness to the Department of Corrections, they have taken steps to try to limit movements within prisons, so people are staying on unit more. They have shut down visiting, which of course has negative consequences for people as well. They have shut down programming again, that has negative consequences. And they have made hygiene supplies more available in many cases, although we don't see necessarily total consistency across the system. The reality that this speaks to for me is that we are warehousing vast numbers of people in these facilities, living in very close quarters to each other. There's a lot of people in facilities where they're sleeping in dorm-style housing. Not everybody is in a cell with, you know, one other person. Some people are sleeping in a big room with a whole bunch of other people.
Thank you. Alice, is there anything else? We're just about at the end of our interview. Is there any updates on the lawsuit? What are the next steps with the lawsuit?
So we had a really important development last week in the lawsuit, which was following the news that we received that David Hart had tested positive for the disease. We started looking at what we could do to help people like him and others who, for whom the prevention part of our lawsuit, which is about getting the governor and DOC to act to help keep people safe from the disease. You know, once you've got it, then the prevention part is over, right? It's too late for you now. You have the disease and you're going to experience whatever level of health consequences come with that. So we started looking at how do we address the harm that people have experienced who have been infected with the disease and whatever health consequences they have suffered from that. So we're actually seeking now to split the classes in the lawsuit into two. So currently we have this one class, which is everybody who's incarcerated in a state prison, and that class are seeking protections from COVID-19. The goal now is to split into two classes, retain the first class of people who haven't been infected, who are seeking protections from the disease, have a second class of people who have been infected, who are seeking financial damages for the harm that they have experienced through contracting the disease. Now, in terms of what that means, you know, seeking financial compensation, but the amount hasn't been determined. That would be worked out later how much that would be. So we're still looking for prevention measures and testing and care from the Department of Corrections. But on the other hand, we're looking also for financial compensation for the people who've contracted the disease. And this will essentially divide people in prison into two categories, depending on whether they fall into the seeking prevention measures category, who haven't had the disease, or the financial compensation category, who have had the disease. This is not confirmed yet that we will be able to amend the classes into two, but that's something that we're seeking to do because we feel like it's really important that there is accountability on the part of Governor Brown and the Department of Corrections. And part of that accountability is for, you know, addressing the harm that has been done by acting deliberately and differently, effectively, to the situation in our prisons. The information has been available all along to everyone, including to the Governor and the Department of Corrections, about what the consequences could be of infection spread within an environment like a prison where it's so easy to spread disease and where the population's already more medically vulnerable. So there should be accountability on the part of the state for failing to act.
Thank you, Alice. If people would like to find out more about the OJRC, if they want to report what's going on with COVID-19 within the prisons, if they're looking for resources, where can they go?
So we have a dedicated resource page on our website, which is www.ojrc.info/COVID-19. And on that page, you can find all the information about what we've been working on, about our lawsuit, our other legal actions. And there are also links there to a printable legal intake questionnaire, which you can send to somebody in a prison in Oregon to fill out and mail back to us. And there are also online surveys there, both for state prisons and a separate one for local jails. And that's where if you are a loved one, friend of somebody who's in a prison or a jail, and they're giving you information about what's happening in their facility, you can fill out that that form online, which basically makes a report to us where you're giving us the information. Whatever you know, you can just share that with us. And all of that information helps to inform the work that we're doing on the lawsuit and in general to try to keep people safe from this disease as best we can.
Thank you. You've been listening to an interview with Alice Lindell from the Oregon Justice Resource Center here on Prison Pipeline on KBOO Community Radio. Alice, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Listening to KBOO Portland.